Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts from George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane while she's out sick. A massive car bomb kills dozens of people in Syria's capital, Damascus. John Kerry makes his first foreign policy speech as Secretary of State. And the number of civilian deaths in Afghanistan drops for the first time in 6 years. Joining me for the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Indira Lakshmanan, sorry, Indira, of Bloomberg News, and Yochi Griesen of Atlantic Media. Welcome. You're all very welcome to be here this morning. Good. Happy to have you. Give us a call. You, as the audience, we're happy to have you, too. 1-800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow, wamu.org. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter. David, John Kerry, first speech as Secretary of State. What did we learn about his priorities?
Well, the speech gave a predictable and sensible priority. He went to the University of Virginia and talked about the importance of foreign aid and the importance of a strong U.S. economy. What we know about his priorities on his first trip, on which he's leaving shortly, is that he wants to move U.S. policy on Syria forward. It's been really in neutral, and that's being generous. Since the summer, there has been discussion within the administration of having a more active program of training and arming of elements of the Syrian opposition. I think it's likely that part of that is going to go forward if it hasn't already. There also has been much more active diplomacy, trying to draw Russia, which has been really the blocking force here, into a diplomatic solution. I was in Munich, Germany, at the beginning of February, where the leader of the Syrian opposition met with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, had a positive meeting. There are continuing meetings between the Russians and the Syrian opposition. There's talk of some kind of effort to get people together in Moscow from the regime and the opposition. So Kerry's going to want to do everything he can to assist that process, lend U.S. support, even as he thinks about getting more involved with the opposition.
Now, Indira, Kerry made a real point of stressing the value of foreign aid. Now, this is at a time when there's a lot of talk about cutting back the federal budget. It's always everybody's favorite target when the public is asked what should be cut from the federal foreign aid, always number one. Why did he go to such pains to try to say in his first speech how important this was?
Right. I mean, I think that David's right that Syria is an important priority for John Kerry, but what actually came out in his speech was a very impassioned appeal for defending foreign aid, the importance of foreign aid, not only development aid, but, you know, other kinds of assistance to governments who are our partners and friends or who we want to be our friends, not to mention the whole idea of commercial diplomacy, which was really promoted under his predecessor, Hillary Clinton. He talked a lot about trade and boosting U.S. exports. So it's funny because, in fact, a lot of our partners in the Middle East, including Turkey and UAE, some of the Gulf states, I was reading the press from those countries, were criticizing Kerry for not laying out his plans on Syria enough and said, why did he spend so much time talking about foreign aid? Why was that the point of his speech? I mean, this is, of course, in a context of sequestration looming over us. While sequestration would affect the State Department budget, it's not the main target that would be hit in the way that the Defense Department would. But I think you saw here an impassioned plea that John Kerry, when he was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was constantly a defender of foreign aid, along with his then Republican counterpart Richard Lugar. And this gave him a real forum, Thomas Jefferson's, right, you know, home university, right, the first Secretary of State, a chance to sort of lay that out. I also thought it was interesting he talked about climate change, which has been a long, long time interest of John Kerry's. I interviewed him in Kyoto during the global warming conference many, many years ago, and he underscored that in his first speech as well.
And a larger theme, as Indira was saying, Yochi, is he was trying to say also the line between foreign and domestic policy is really blurring. You talk about climate change. Is that a domestic issue? Is it a foreign issue? It's obviously both. Trade, immigration, infectious diseases, flows of capital. He's taking over at a time when this line really is blurring, and I thought it was interesting that he tried to make that point in his speech.
I think you nailed it on the head. I mean, you also have this weirdness of Panetta, Leon Panetta, who thought by this point he'd be back in California on his walnut farm, having to now give speeches about Syria, about Israel, about issues he thought would be Chuck Hagel's issues to deal with. So you have not just the economic flow that you're talking about between domestic and foreign, but you also have just the weird politics, the politics of sequestration, where the Pentagon is kind of preoccupied with it as opposed to military issues, the politics of who gets confirmed and when, John Brennan at the CIA being held up. So allies of ours in the intel world looking at and thinking, this is the most important job, arguably, in Washington, and it's open. One point I wanted to make quickly on the foreign aid issue, I think it's not simply that this is always the piñata that's hit whenever there's an attempt to cut the budget. There is a real question on the Hill. You hear from Republicans primarily, but also from Democrats, about the money that's being funneled to the Pakistanis, the money that's being funneled to the Egyptians, billions upon billions of dollars. What are we as a government getting back in return? So this pressure is not simply to cut the budget for budget cutting's sake. It's a question, I think it's a legitimate one, of for the money we're giving Pakistan, what do we get back? For the money we're giving Egypt, given its current tensions with Israel, what are we getting back? And I think that will be one of the major questions going forward.
Right. And David, you brought up the issue of Syria, and with Kerry going on his first trip to Europe and then to the Middle East. In Syria just yesterday, a car bomb, at least 53 dead, some estimates higher. But not clear who was behind it. What's your best reading of the importance of this event and how it relates to the civil war raging through Syria right now?
This was a big, horrifying bombing. The estimates do range 53 up to 72 dead, several hundred wounded. I think as important as the numbers, the fact that this was towards central Damascus. It was near the Ba'ath Party headquarters. It was near the Russian embassy. The war in the Damascus area has mostly been in the suburbs. The rebels increasingly control the east and south. The regime holds the north and west. But what's been happening in the last few weeks is that rebel fighters have been coming towards Damascus for what they see as a final battle. This bombing, just by its nature, you'd have to assume was done by people aligned with the rebels. And it illustrates that on the rebel side, there are people who are in the business of what we would call terrorism.
A word the State Department used to describe this.
Well,
bombing.
And appropriately so. When you kill 50 plus people and wound 200 in the center of a city, that's an act of terrorism. And that raises the hardest dilemma of this war, I think, which is that the opposition that is bravely fighting Bashar al-Assad with the support of the United States and almost the whole world has as one of its strongest elements militarily groups that are essentially terrorist groups that are allied with, in some cases, literally progeny of al-Qaeda. And somehow the U.S. has got to get involved enough that it can strengthen the more moderate forces so they have a chance of helping to run a new Syria that's not a terrorist safe haven.
And one of the other dimensions of this story this week in Deraa, threats from the Syrian rebels to attack targets of Hezbollah across the line in northern Lebanon. And this is not just factions. This relates to much larger geopolitical and tribal and religious forces in the area. So give us a sense of why this was a significant advance here.
Right. This is very significant because if indeed the Syrian rebels, who at the time gave a 48-hour ultimatum to Hezbollah saying, stop shelling us from the Lebanese side of the border or we will attack you. What's striking about this is it not only raises the specter that people have been talking about for 2 years now since this conflict began, which is regional, you know, the spread of this fire throughout the Levant, throughout the Mideast, a very scary thought. It also brings up sectarian issues because of the split between Shias and Sunnis and the fact that Hezbollah is largely Shiite and a lot of the Syrian rebels are largely Sunni, as are the countries in the Middle East and the Gulf who back them. Again, remember that Iran, a big funder of Hezbollah, and Syria, who's gotten aid and assistance from Hezbollah in the fight, also the leadership Shia. areas. So it brings up the regional spread fear, the sectarian dynamic, which is very scary. And you know, just going back to something David said, I think that this incredible car bomb and all that, you know, the days after days of this violence that we see, it doesn't change on the television screen. It just underscores the incredible gulf between the violence that continues and the hopes for supposed peace talks, which are going nowhere. And again, the fact that we don't know who's in this opposition, and that makes it very hard to support, you know, that's part of the reason that the U.S. has held back from arming the opposition, because we don't know who's in there, who are these terrorist groups. So the whole thing is a mess that doesn't look like it's getting any better.
And one dimension of this mess, in Indira's words, is the refugee problem. Some estimates from the UN this week, there are many as 70,000 casualties, many more refugees flooding across the borders, spread of typhoid in northern Syria. Update us on that, Yochi.
I mean, it's a major humanitarian disaster. If you think back to the start of the Iraq War, there was a fear then that there would be a major flow of refugees when the U.S. went into Iraq in 2003. That didn't happen. Over the course of the Civil War, you saw some numbers go. It was significant. Here you have refugees going to Jordan. You have some refugees trying to get into Turkey. You have this broadening of the refugee crisis, a lack of food, a lack of tents, a lack of water. It's not clear who will fund it. It's not clear if these countries will at some point close their borders. If, as you know, David and Indira both point out, there is a terrorist element, you could imagine Jordan saying, we don't want refugees because we don't know who's coming across our border. We don't want people who might target us because we're a monarchy that they see as apostates. So you have the fear not just of a refugee crisis on the humanitarian grounds, but of a country sealing its border. And then it just obviously ricochets and makes the humanitarian crisis worse. A very quick point to one of the things David mentioned. Earlier, we've had suicide bombings targeting military targets in Syria that we haven't been as concerned about. A bombing like this killing civilians is obviously terrorism, and it caused much greater concern.
That's Yochi Driessen of the Atlantic Media. Indira Lakshman is with me from Bloomberg News, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And this is our international hour, our second hour of always on Friday morning. David Ignatius of The Washington Post is with me. Indira Lakshman of Bloomberg News, Yochi Driessen of The Atlantic. And you can, I should mention, Yochi has a new book out, about to come out, called The Invisible Front. It's on military suicides. And congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you can join our conversation, 1-800-433-8850. Give us a call. Send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. I should also mention your book, David, Blood Money, your latest novel. This is your fourth or fifth novel?
It's my eighth.
Eighth.
My
goodness.
Believe it or not.
You're far more productive than the rest of us. I want to turn to the subject of Iran, since we mentioned it. And Indira, you're about to go tomorrow to Kazakhstan, where there's a renewal of these talks, six-party talks. Give us an update on what we can expect.
Yeah. It's been an eight-month lapse since we had three rounds of talks that didn't go anywhere, really, other than the agreement to continue meeting last year. So what is referred to as the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the United Nations Security Council plus Germany, meeting as the international representatives, trying to negotiate with Iran over their nuclear program and trying to get Iran to give up what the international community considers illicit aspects of their atomic program and possible cover for a covert nuclear weapons capability program. So I have talked to diplomats from nearly every country that's involved, including Iran, and I have to say that the expectations are not very high for what's going to happen at next week's meetings in Almaty on February 26th. I think at the same time, the diplomats feel that the talks have to go on. There's no alternative, that what needs to be done is little by little build confidence so that there can be some kind of step-by-step agreements. The problem is that the trust deficit on the two sides between Iran and the international community is just a yawning chasm. It's huge. From the international community's perspective, they don't believe that Iran truly has a peaceful program and that Iran is going to give anything up. And Iran, from its side, doesn't believe that the international community and the U.S. in particular is not actually imposing sanctions as a way to try to bring about economic collapse and regime change. So you've got a very difficult starting position. But on the one positive side, I will say that the fears of an imminent military strike appear to have largely abated. That concern we had last year when Israel's leaders were giving out the message that they would use force if necessary, that doesn't seem to be an imminent risk at this moment. And the best hope seems to be that talks would just continue to a next step.
On that point, you reported this week that one of the reasons why Israel said at the time of that concern that Iran was approaching a red line. But you reported this week that Iran is being careful not to cross that red line.
It's interesting because on the one hand, Iran is expanding its nuclear program, and we see that from the UN Atomic Energy Agency's report that just came out this week. They're installing advanced centrifuges and really upping their capability for enriching uranium. At the same time, they are increasing the amount of the 20% uranium that they're putting into powder form and then into plates for the medical reactor, and that makes it harder to convert it into bomb-grade fuel. So they're trying to be careful, it seems, to not cross the line.
Now, David, you too this week had a conversation, I think it was with the Iran's UN ambassador.
Yes.
And you filed a blog post for the Washington Post coming to a very similar conclusion than Deere did.
I did. On Wednesday night, the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations, Mohammad Khazayi, made an unusual appearance before the Asia Society in New York and took questions from me and in exchange with Thomas Pickering, who's a former U.S. ambassador who's been very involved in behind-the-scenes track two diplomacy with Iran. And if to sum up, I would say that on details of what an agreement would look like, the Iranian ambassador was surprisingly forthcoming. He said, we're prepared to negotiate. We're prepared to negotiate directly with the United States. The details of how much enriched uranium we hold, what level we enrich, those are things we're prepared to talk about, so long as our right to enrich is respected. But, he said, the problem is the overall atmosphere of deep mistrust and suspicion on both sides, as Indira said. So, as he said at one point, my answer is yes and no. So I think most of us looking at these talks next week in Kazakhstan don't expect any breakthroughs. This is going to be a long process. It's going to take a long time to ripen. The central point that he made that Americans are really going to have to struggle with is we are not prepared to negotiate with a gun to our heads. In Iranian culture, that's obviously a loss of face. It's humiliating.
But this is an age-old problem. Do you impose sanctions, or do they have almost a negative
effect? This is why there's a need for a behind-the-scenes meeting between the United States and Iran to explore what a deal would look like. I mean, the U.S. isn't going to, and its allies, are not going to remove sanctions until they know they have the essence of a deal. And you won't get that unless you have these quiet quiet talks.
Now, Indira, you reported in your story that there's an offer on the table for a sidebar, for a one-on-one conversation in Kazakhstan.
That's right. I mean, Vice President Joe Biden made that offer publicly at the Munich Security Conference, and the diplomats who I've talked to said it's still on the table. And the Iranians have given mixed signals about whether they'd be open to that. I mean, I think on the record they've said, you know, of course we're open to it. The question is, where would it go? And some of the diplomats I spoke to said, look, if you're really serious about diplomacy, everyone knows what this deal looks like at the end of the day. I mean, that was something that a former U.S. State Department advisor, Vali Nasser, who's now at Johns Hopkins as the dean at SAIS, said to me. Everyone knows what this deal looks like. The question is, it's going to take a long time and patience, and how do you get there? And I think the key question at this point is, are more sanctions helping the process or hurting the process? And as David points out, the Iranians say it's like putting a gun to our head. So that becomes the big question about U.S. policy going forward.
Yochi, I want you to turn to another part of the world, and that's Afghanistan, where there was news this week that, in fact, there had been a decrease in civilian deaths, although in certain categories, particularly women and children, there were increases. Give us an update on what it looks like on the ground there, and what's the importance of this report?
I think we're seeing, for the moment, a sort of a slackening of the war, a sort of a pause on all sides. The U.S. is obviously on the way out. The Taliban is, I think, trying to figure out how to recalibrate itself as the U.S. leaves and what it should be doing after the U.S. goes. Should it become something on the model of Hezbollah, a political force legitimized with the militia that's either set aside, not disarmed, it's not a militia that's going to go away, but does it try to formally enter a political process? Does it try to simply conquer parts of the country as it did in the past, very likely the South and the East? But I think what you're seeing beginning to emerge is the end of this war as we thought of it. There will be a political process in Afghanistan. There'll be fighting within Afghanistan, but it will not be something led by the U.S. It will not be something led by NATO. One thing that was lost a bit this week was some of the planning emerging on the numbers you're beginning to hear. You're hearing 6,000, 8,000, 10,000 roughly for American NATO troops, Americans being the bulk of it. What was most interesting, though, isn't the number. It was word coming out yesterday and today that there'll be troops not simply in the east and south, which is where the fighting is, but in the north and west. And if you have troops in the north and west, where there's almost no violence whatsoever, you're talking about whatever this number is being somewhat artificial, because a good chunk of them would be in areas where there is no fighting whatsoever. Isn't so the U.S. Presence would be tiny.
Hasn't this long been almost a requirement of European presence in Afghanistan, that they send troops, but they don't want them in the combat area?
Exactly right. I mean, I've been embedded with troops from NATO countries where they could literally not leave their base without permission from their capital. They couldn't go out at night without permission from their capital. And many of those European nations insisted, the Italians in particular, in being in the north and the west, precisely because there was no fighting. But if you have the U.S. presence also begin to shift from the south and the east, where it's been for the last few years, to the north and the west, it's a very different war. And it makes this troop debate become somewhat distorted and artificial.
And another news story this week, David, related to Afghanistan, General Allen, who had been commander of American forces in Afghanistan and seemed to be up for the job of NATO commander. And he stepped aside this week and said that he had his wife was very ill and he wanted to spend more time with her. But there was a shadow. He was been cleared of any wrongdoing, but there was that flurry over the summer of the vast number of emails he exchanged with a socialite in Florida. Give us an update on General Allen.
Well, this was a sad end to what, by every account I've heard, was a really remarkable military career. General John Allen, Marine, four-star, in a lot of people's estimation, was the best U.S. commander in Kabul through the long course of this war. He got caught up in the fallout from the Dave Petraeus email scandal that forced Petraeus' resignation as CIA director. And the FBI collected, it was said, thousands of emails between General Allen and this woman, Jill Kelly, who had been in Tampa when he was CENTCOM commander, and kind of dumped them in the Pentagon's lap. And so it fell to Leon Panetta to make a judgment about what to do. Should these be investigated formally by the inspector general, or should he kind of take it on his own shoulders? And the initial review was that there was no criminal activity, certainly, by General Allen. Well, you know, in the Washington fashion, Secretary Panetta decided to order an investigation, thinking it would look bad if he seemed to be covering it up and Allen's nomination was going for it. So that was suspended. And, you know, frankly, the minute that investigation was begun, you knew how the story was going to end. And it ended with Allen pulling his nomination back, fearing that when he went up to be confirmed, emails would be leaked in a way that would be damaging to him and his wife, who's very ill. So it was, as I say, it was a sad end to a distinguished career.
And Indira, another story out of Asia this week involving China and the ongoing story of hacking into American computer systems. And one report said this week that they traced the origins of this hacking scheme to a shadowy Chinese military unit, Unit 61398, in a nondescript office building in Shanghai. Give us an update on that story.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really fascinating story with huge legs. I just wanted to make one last point about Afghanistan, which is while the civilian casualties are down for the first time in 6 years, there were still 7,500 Afghan civilians killed. So that's a huge number, and we have to remember part of the reason more Afghan soldiers are dying and fewer American soldiers is because we're pulling back and they're taking the lead. They are now seeing five times the deaths. The Chinese cyber story is a fascinating one, and this big report that was prepared by Mandiant, which is this Virginia-based security company. Basically, they went through hundreds and hundreds of their investigations for firms that had been hacked and came out with this report saying that they had definitive proof that this group, as you referred to, Unit 61398, was part of the Chinese PLA, People's Liberation Army, is behind these cyber attacks. Now, this is incredible because it brings together two things. One is corporate espionage and that whole concern. And the other one is the whole concern about information that was taken that has to do with critical grids, power grids and networks. And that brings on then a national security aspect that goes far beyond just corporate espionage. So it's something Obama was trying to take on in his State of the Union address with the executive order that he issued.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Yochi, what are the implications here of these proliferation of stories about cyber attacks from China and other places? And how serious a threat is it to American security? And what are the options that the Obama administration has to fight back?
Certainly, when you talk to the Pentagon, they see it as very severe. Mm-hmm. I mean, the corporate espionage piece is huge. If you have American companies having plans, strategic, having design plans hacked, that's one issue. But they estimate that there's more than a million attempts per day by Chinese government agencies to hack the Pentagon systems, just the Pentagon. That's in addition to hacking State Department, in addition to trying to hack the White House. The U.S. feels right now fairly confident that it's able to rebuff those attacks, but there's also a sense that we are not quite keeping up, that the U.S. set up a command solely to do cyber defense, offensive cyber warfare. It's been slow to be established, and we don't have the lead the Chinese have. A quick thing on China that I think was somewhat obscure this week because of the hacking. There was a fascinating story about China talking about using a drone to kill a drug lord in Myanmar. Interesting, not because it was a drug lord in Myanmar, although kind of interesting there too, but this is one of the first times you've begun to hear states openly talk about using methods we've been using for years, sending drones into other sovereign countries without the permission of those countries to kill people, not caring particularly about sovereignty, not caring about borders. And it's fascinating because you see, one, the spread of drone technology. We thought that was a U.S.-controlled issue. It's not. Israel developing armed drones, Russia, China, Hezbollah. But also because what happens when these attacks start to happen? The U.S. has said, we have the ability to do it. How can we condemn China when China says the same thing? So the drone issue, I think, got a little bit obscured because the hacking is obviously hugely important. But over the next 5, 10, 15 years, the drone issue has become more important by the day and by the week as that technology spreads.
Thanks for bringing up that point, a very interesting point. Also in Asia, David, this week, we've had a third test from the nuclear test from North Korea and some pretty volatile language from a North Korean official toward the South. Give us a sense of what the importance of this story.
The North Koreans, in one of these bombastic statements that they issue from time to time, threatened the final destruction of South Korea, warned that if the South Koreans and Americans didn't pull back, that they would unleash death and destruction. North Korea is a wild card in the international situation. that I don't see anybody really having a good feel for. I think U.S. intelligence about North Korea, about its new leader, Kim Jong-un, is very shaky. You can see that the Chinese are very concerned and uncertain about what to do. For China, this is a problem that one senses they wish would go away, but they're not really prepared to do a lot about it, fearing the repercussions of a change of regime in North Korea. And North Korea keeps marching forward. It just had its third nuclear test. It's been warned. It's been sanctioned. It's been threatened. And it just keeps on going. There's a new young leader who is trying to consolidate power and get the military behind him, who clearly is a risk taker. So I find this is an issue where people in Washington and overseas scratch their heads. They don't know what to do about it. They see how dangerous it is, but they don't have good solutions.
And this language, Indira, was clearly an escalation. I mean, we're used to saber-rattling from North Korea, but this is pretty harsh language.
Well, they use this kind of language all the time. If you read the official KCNA government news agency reports, what was stunning about this was the context that you had here, the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations Conference on Disarmament, in a UN setting in Geneva, you know, declaring that his country was going to destroy its southern neighbor. I mean, that was so stunning that you saw diplomats from the United States, Spain, and all over scratching their heads and saying, isn't this illegal for him to make this threat? So it takes it another step beyond what we've seen before. And they've given private messages that they might do more tests to try to force the U.S. back to the negotiating table.
Indira Lakshman of Bloomberg News, David Ignatius, Washington Post, Yochi Driesen of The Atlantic. I'll be right back with your calls and your comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
What was the last movie you produced?
High and Dry.
Who paid for that?
CFDC.
What's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Leon?
Shoot him. He's an American spy.
Argo is nominated for 7 Oscars. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the director, Ben Affleck, and from Bradley Cooper, the star of Silver Linings Playbook, which is nominated for 8 Oscars. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's out sick. And this is the second hour of our Friday News Roundup, our international hour. And Indira Lakshman of Bloomberg News is with me, David Ignatius, The Washington Post, Yochi Driesen of The Atlantic. And Yochi, here's an email from Stuart in Cincinnati. If, as your guests say, nearly everyone in the world is against Assad, why can't the entire world defeat him?
I think if the entire world wanted to defeat him, they could. The issue is very few people want to get involved in what could be a long, protracted, horrifically bloody civil war, sectarian war, where different cities fall, different factions emerge. You can tell from everything the U.S. has said, it wants no part of this, nothing whatsoever. You had the White House basically overruled the Pentagon and the CIA when there was a plan to arm the rebels, and the White House basically said no. You saw in the State of the Union a single sentence about Syria, which said nothing. So it's not a question of capability, it's a question of will. The will is not there, and until you begin to see the will emerge, you won't see much more than you're seeing now. You might see more intelligence sharing, bit of arms being passed to the rebels, but you will not see a U.S.-led coalition bombing Assad's government directly.
But you, earlier in the program, David Ignatius said that this is high on the new Secretary of State John Kerry's list, and that in his trip he's going to be focusing on Syria, but you're saying he has very few options.
He may focus on it diplomatically, and as Indira said earlier, there may be some movement. But in terms of the U.S. putting a coalition together to bomb Assad, in terms of the French doing it unilaterally like they did for a while in Libya, now in Mali, you're not going to see that. You see most of the world wanting no part of anything on the ground, no part of anything that could descend into a war that yanks them in and goes on for years.
We have another email from Joe who says, in reference, Indira, to Iran, negotiations seem moot because there was no trust on either side, something you and David both said. So why not implement a policy whereby if Iran develops a nuke, a first strike option is initiated? Otherwise, isn't this all a silly dance?
Well, I think effectively that's what President Obama has already said. He has said that the U.S. red line is that Iran cannot get a nuclear weapon and that all options are on the table. So I think pretty much he's made it clear, and so has Israel, that if they were to do that, there would be consequences. The whole problem is Iran can walk right up to that line and stop there. It can be so-called a screwdriver turn away from having a nuclear weapon and not actually cross the line. And then that brings us into the whole question of containment. Are we then, you know, if they haven't developed a weapon, so then we don't really have a reason to strike, are we then just effectively containing them, even if they have that breakout capability? So it's a complicated question.
David?
I think, in fact, we are heading towards what Indira just suggested, which is Iran having a pre-nuclear power status, where Iran has the technology, it has the enriched material ready to go the last step. If just look at the latest evidence, they're adding a lot more modern centrifuges, which would allow them to take 20% enriched material and fairly quickly get it to bomb grade so it'd be ready for a weapon. At the same time, they're converting a substantial part of their existing 20% enriched stockpile into the non-gaseous state in which you would enrich it further into fuel plates or rods, which take a little while to convert back. So they're in effect, I think, saying we're going to do it with an agreement or not. We're going to have our enriched material, but we're going to stop short of the line. And I think the U.S. is going to have a very difficult decision if that happens. Because it meets President Obama's test. They don't possess a nuclear weapon, but they possess the ability to break out quickly. And that's what the U.S. is going to have to decide whether it's willing to live with.
And Yochi, what does that also mean for the Israelis, who have been more aggressive in talking about necessity for military action?
That will be one of the toughest choices any Israeli prime minister will have had to make in the history of Israel. Is that something that they will see as they're willing to accept Obama's position? They're willing to trust the U.S.? There is a trust gap right now between Israel and the U.S., and there has been since President Obama took office. For that matter, there's a trust gap between the Gulf states and the Obama administration about how serious it is about stopping Iran from taking that final step. It will be the question of Netanyahu's term, the question of the history of his term in office, and frankly, a historic question for the state of Israel.
Let me turn to our callers now. Patricia in Mayfield Village, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Patricia.
Good morning. I would like you all to discuss further what you did in the beginning of the program regarding foreign aid and possibly which countries could have less foreign aid since the public does cry out to cut without compromising any of the United States relationships. And further, I would love to see the Globe and the Times, either one or either blog, publish a list of what countries and how much they receive in this area of cost cutting. It would help me to make a better informed decision so I may contact my legislator and give him my viewpoint on choices.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call, Patricia. Appreciate it. David, what's your reaction?
Well, when you look at foreign aid totals, I believe the largest recipients have been Israel and Egypt, both of which were promised foreign aid as part of the
original. And that was primarily military aid.
A lot of it is military aid. There's pressure now to think about cutting assistance to Egypt because of concern about President Morsi's behavior. I think there may be pressure to cut aid to Israel in part because Israel is a prosperous country. When President Obama goes to Israel on this long-delayed trip, but finally go there next month, it's interesting that he's going to receive a medal, which is for one fruit of U.S. assistance to Israel and cooperation, which is the quite successful, it appears, anti-missile defense system known as Iron Dome that the U.S. during the Obama administration has supported with money, research, unusual cooperation. So I think that's when the caller asks about this issue, that's a kind of hidden benefit, at least certainly to Israel, but I think to everyone of this assistance.
Let me turn to Nicole in New York, who also wants to talk about the aid issue, I believe. Nicole, you're on the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for this panel, and I hope Ms. Rehm feels better soon. I am asking two specific questions related to foreign aid. One, whether or not Secretary Kerry will look into the aid effectiveness, particularly in countries, say, like Haiti and other places at a time when the USAID there was some reports about some contract rigging that is being investigated by Congress, Daryl Issa. And the second point is, how is foreign aid seen in other parts of the world that suspect that it may be used for spy or other activities? And I'm thinking about the doctor in Pakistan who used the cover of vaccinations to get some information to track Osama bin Laden. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Nicole, thank you. Indira.
To the larger point, I want to say that the entire U.S. foreign policy budget is only 1% of the national budget. And so when we talk about, when the previous caller talked about she wanted to write to her congressperson and, you know, what needs to be cut, you are not going to find much money to cut here. You know, Kerry made the point in his speech that the State Department's conflict stabilization budget is $60 million a year, which is the same amount that it costs to make the movie The Avengers, it's the same amount that the movie The Avengers took in one Sunday. And so, you know, the question is, not a lot of our money goes to foreign aid. And 11 of the top 15 U.S. trade partners are former recipients of U.S. foreign aid. So, you know, you have to put that all in perspective. To the question of...
That's partly why Secretary Kerry used the word investment
right.
in describing foreign aid.
Right. And, you know, to go to the point of corruption and misuse of funds, I think that's a very legitimate point. And there are, you know, inspector generals who are inspecting AID and, you know, not just Congress to make sure that the money is spent appropriately. And I'm sure there are cases everywhere in the world where it might not be. But I don't know if that's a reason to cut off foreign aid, particularly when it's a drop in the bucket of the U.S. budget.
Let me turn to Mazen in Little Rock. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show, Mazen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm from Syria. I lived there until I was 28. I'd like to raise a couple of points, see what you guys think of. Regarding the car bomb in Damascus yesterday, neither the Syrian government nor any independent agency have conducted any formal investigation. But the anecdotal evidence, I think, suggests that the regime is responsible for the attack. Every car bomb or attack that the rebels claimed responsibility for was never on the Syrian TV and was never even acknowledged by the Syrian government. But the attack yesterday, the Syrian TV was on the scene only a few minutes afterwards, and one of their guests who appeared as a bystander had appeared time after time, in similar situation after bombs, to basically blame the rebels and the jihadis. And even the New York Times website commented on that yesterday, and all the YouTube videos are available for this particular person.
Okay. Let me get an answer to that question. Yochi?
You know, the first part of this question I would take issue with, because the Syrian government has tried actually to call attention to what it says are bombings against civilian targets for months. They always claim that these bombings are the work of terrorists, which is their term for the rebels. So it isn't that these attacks haven't been claimed, by the rebels, and isn't that they haven't been acknowledged by the government. Both have taken place. The question is, who's actually responsible? To the first part, it's interesting because we all know the Middle East loves conspiracy theories. If you flash back about a decade, there was a series of bombings in Moscow targeting apartment buildings, allegedly claimed by Chechen rebels. That was one of the pretexts for a massive Russian invasion of Chechnya. There's been a conspiracy there ever since that Russia staged those bombings to set the stage for what it wanted to do in Chechnya. So this conspiracy theory isn't something that's being pulled out of the air, and it's not something that hasn't been used in other parts of the world as well.
Indira, there was one other story I wanted to mention quickly, and that was the visit of Prime Minister David Cameron in India. And he went to the site of the massacre, the Amritsar massacre, where almost 400 Indians were killed by British troops. And he wrote in the guest book that this was a deeply shameful incident, but others said, well, but that's not a full apology. Your read.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is not the first world leader to, you know, reference past sins by his government, like people taking responsibility for slavery or things like that. But as you say, he didn't go as far as taking responsibility. He expressed regret, but not a full apology. What's interesting is it's almost 100 years since that 1919 Jallianwala Bagh massacre of the British troops against peaceful protesters at the Sikh Golden Temple in Amritsar. And what I found fascinating is I was reading the Indian press to see what they said about it. And the Indian press found one old survivor of the massacre who was had been a four-year-old boy at the time with his uncle and his dad, who said that he really appreciated the regret that was expressed by David Cameron. But, you know, it was interesting that some of the others said, okay, well, now, while he's expressing regret, can he also give back the Koh-i-Noor diamond, the 105-carat diamond that's in the Queen's crown? And David Cameron said, no, we're not going to give that back to India.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have time for a couple of more callers, and let's go to Ahmed in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. A short time before 1988 U.S. presidential election, Obama appeared on NBC Meet the Press with Tom Brokaw, who filled in for Tom Russell, and he said he wants to separate Syria from Iran. And unless the U.S. does something about resolving the crisis in Syria, how can this process, how can he be able to do that?
Okay. You got a reaction?
I think the U.S. Would love to see a new Syrian regime for many reasons, but one of them is that a new regime would be almost certain to have less friendly ties with Iran. Syria has been Iran's most important ally in the Arab world, the gateway for supplying Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I think one issue that will be ahead is if the U.S. decides to go down the track of some kind of negotiated settlement brokered by Russia, the price of that might be continued Iranian influence in a successor regime, or at least nothing like the sharp break that would follow the overthrow of Assad if the war continues. So that's certainly an issue. But no question that for the U.S., a big strategic gain of Assad's fall would be the end of Iranian influence.
Let's turn to Rod in Plymouth, Michigan, I believe. Rod, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi there. I teach civics and AP U.S. history, and we talk a lot about American power, how it's used in the world. And, you know, I wouldn't say that the Obama diplomatic efforts have been a failure so far, but it's kind of missed that big score. Do you think it's because of a flaw in their approach? Do you think it's because of reflects decline of American power or something else?
Yochi?
First, I wish that when I had been in high school, I had a teacher who talked about the use of American power abroad. That was definitely not the level of teaching that I got. So, Rod, kudos. I think that it is, in some ways, a reflection of a slight diminishment that other countries see in our economic power, certainly. But I think it's also that this administration looked back to the Bush White House, saw it embroiled in Iraq, saw it embroiled in Afghanistan, and did not think that's what the U.S. should do. It thought the military was exhausted, which is true. It thought that we were bankrupt enough that we couldn't afford it, which is arguably also true. It just did not want to be involved. So it pulled out of Iraq and left no troops. It will pull out of Afghanistan and leave far fewer troops than I think people thought even a few months ago. Did not want to be involved in Libya, did not want to be involved in Syria. And you could argue that that's actually been a very smart approach, that these are not, certainly the case of Libya, these are not core strategic interests in the United States. And keeping ourselves out of these issues is itself a triumph because we could so easily have been yanked into them.
But David, it's a lot of commentary with the start of the president's second term that often in a second term, and this has been a historic pattern, presidents turn to foreign policy for legacy reasons. It gets them out of the United States and away from domestic partisanship. With a new Secretary of State, as you were talking about earlier, do you see any change from the pattern that Yochi was talking about?
Well, I think everything Yochi said is right about the President Obama's desire to end foreign wars, but that doesn't explain why he was not successful in getting diplomatic solutions or diplomatic progress. This is a president who came to office wanting to make foreign policy a priority. I remember his Cairo speech where he said the Palestinian situation is intolerable. And he'd really made no progress on it. And you could make similar arguments about other key trouble spots. So I think in the second term, President Obama means what he said often in speeches. I want nation building at home, not abroad. He's got a foreign policy team that is conflict resistant. He has a Secretary of State who'd love to make deals. I mean, John Kerry's going to be out looking for diplomatic engagement everywhere. Will he have the backing of the president to do those deals? That's the question I'm looking at.
Very quickly.
Three words, domestic political pressure. That's why President Obama has not done the extending of the hand, because of Republican pressure and pressure within his own White House about what is politically acceptable. So we'll see. But I'm not optimistic that that's going to change. We'll see.
That's Indira Lakshmanan. I'm going to mangle your name
Lakshmanan.
Again. Lakshmanan. I got it.
Perfect.
From Bloomberg, Yochi Drizin from The Atlantic, David Ignatius from The Washington Post. Yochi's new book is The Invisible Front. David's book is Blood Money, a novel of espionage. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Moss. She's out sick. And thanks so much for spending an hour of your morning with us.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yorv-Lifker answers the phones.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from